Chapter 10, Proof of Healing. Several days after coming out of the ICU, I started physical therapy to strengthen my muscles. The first day that I could walk across the room, a nurse took me into the bathroom so that I could see myself in the mirror. As I looked at my skeletal reflection, my heart sank. It was the first time since coming out of the coma that I felt disheartened. I asked the nurse to leave me alone for a few minutes so that I could have some privacy. I just continued to gaze at myself in the mirror. I almost didn't know the person who looked back at me, almost couldn't recognize her. Most of my hair had fallen out in great clumps. My eyes seemed too big for their sockets. My cheekbones jutted out. And I had a bandage on the side of my neck below my right ear, hiding a huge, open skin lesion. I stood riveted by my own image, and I began to cry. I wept not for the sake of my vanity. My physical appearance didn't seem important in that moment. Instead, I had the same deep sadness that anyone would feel when looking at a person in that condition. I felt sorrow combined with profound empathy. I could see in that image, in that face, in those eyes, the years of pain that it took to get where I was today, standing there in front of the mirror. How could I have allowed myself to go through so much anguish? How could I cause myself this much pain? I grieved. Yes, it felt as though I'd done it to myself. I reached my hand up towards the mirror, and as I touched the image of my tearful face, I made a promise that I'd never hurt myself so badly again. The doctors were being cautious about my healing, particularly because of the state I was in when I entered the hospital. They wanted to adjust the mix and dosage of the chemotherapy they were giving me, which, at one time, I'd greatly feared. I watched as the nurses came in to administer the chemo. They hung the bags of drugs on the IV stand. Each bag, which they were feeding directly into my veins, were labeled poison, in huge red capital letters. The nurses wore masks and latex gloves so they couldn't accidentally have contact with any of the dangerous chemicals. Strangely, it seemed that it was acceptable for these drugs to be introduced directly into my bloodstream. I knew I didn't need the chemo. The doctors were administering it for their own reasons, not mine, for I knew that I was invincible. Nothing could destroy me. Not even poison injected directly into my veins, the very thing I'd feared for so many years. Interestingly, I didn't suffer from the normal side effects. My medical team was very surprised that I didn't have the usual nausea associated with the treatment. I felt a level of victory. I'd so completely overcome my fear of everything, from dying to cancer to chemotherapy, that this proved to me that it had been the fear destroying me. I felt invincible. I knew that the decision to come back that I'd made on the other side completely overrode anything going on in the physical world. The doctors wanted to conduct a range of tests to obtain a more accurate picture of my present situation and to adjust the chemo dosage accordingly. I reluctantly agreed, mostly because I knew that they needed the tests more than I did as proof that I was healed, but also partly because I already knew what the results would be. It would give me a sense of victory to prove myself correct. However, the doctors felt that I was still too weak to withstand extensive testing, so they decided to spread the procedures over a couple of weeks while I continued to get stronger. I weighed less than 90 pounds, and I was required to get my nutrition levels up before any tests that involved even minor surgery, since any additional healing requirements might put a strain on my already depleted resources. My skin lesions were huge gaping wounds that were being cleaned and dressed every day by the nursing staff. Because the lesions were both wide and deep, the doctors felt that they wouldn't heal without intervention. My body had neither the nutrition nor the strength required to recover from major injuries, so a reconstructive surgeon came to assess the situation. He confirmed that my wounds were indeed too large to heal on their own, particularly since my body didn't have the nutrients necessary to support the process. However, he felt that I was still too frail to withstand reconstructive surgery and requested that the nurses continue to keep the lesions clean and dressed until I built up enough strength for the procedure. I still had barely any muscle or flesh on my bones. About 6 days after coming out of the ICU, I began to feel a little bit stronger and was starting to walk up and down the hospital corridor for short periods of time before needing to rest. The first test that the doctors decided that I was strong enough to endure was a bone marrow biopsy. This is a very painful procedure that consists of a thick needle being inserted into the base of the spine to withdraw marrow from the bone. It's common for advanced stage lymphoma to metastasize to the bone marrow, so the doctors were expecting to see this confirmed in my test results. They intended to use these results to determine which drugs to put me on and what the dosage should be. I recall the day I got the results. The doctor came into my room with a whole team of hospital personnel, looking concerned. Then he spoke. "We have the results of the bone marrow biopsy, but it's a little disturbing." For the first time in days, I felt some anxiety. "Why? What's the problem?" My family members were in the hospital room with me, and all of them looked worried. "We can't find the cancer in your bone marrow biopsy," he said. "So how's that a problem?" Danny asked. "Doesn't that just mean she doesn't have cancer in her bone marrow?" "No, that's not possible," the doctor said. "She definitely has cancer in her body. It can't just disappear so quickly like that. We simply have to find it. And until we do, it's a problem because I'm unable to determine her drug dose." So the doctors then sent my bone marrow sample to one of the most sophisticated pathology labs in the country. 4 days later, the results returned negative. There was no trace of cancer. I felt an overwhelming sense of victory upon hearing the news. Not to be defeated, however, the doctors then wanted to conduct a lymph node biopsy to find the cancer. At first, my newfound sense of self made me want to retaliate and tell them, "No, you will not conduct any more tests because it's my body and I already know that you won't find anything." However, as the doctors continued to insist, reminding my family of the state I was in when I entered the hospital just a few short days prior, I decided to let them go ahead because I knew full well that they wouldn't find anything. I also realized that it would continue to bring me a sense of victory to trump every medical test they gave me. I actually said to the doctor, "Do what you need to do, but I want you to know that you're all doing this to convince yourselves. I already know the results." They gave me another few days to build up some strength for the lymph node biopsy, which entailed minor surgery. Just prior to the procedure, I was sent down to the radiology department. The radiologist was to use ultrasound equipment to find the largest lymph node and mark the spot on my skin where the surgeon could make the incision for the biopsy. As I lay there on the table in the radiology lab, I noticed that my earlier scans, taken the day I entered the hospital, were pinned up on the light box, showing where all the tumors were. The radiologist noted from those scans that my neck was ridden with swollen glands and tumors, so he ran the ultrasound machine along the back of my neck up to the base of my skull. Then he moved it along the sides of my neck, and finally up and down the front of my neck. I noticed confusion and bewilderment building up on his face. He went back to refer to the scans hanging on the light box, then returned to where I was lying on the table. He asked if he could use the ultrasound under my arms. I said okay, but after checking that area, he still looked bewildered. He then scanned my chest, back, and abdomen. "Is everything okay?" I asked. "I'm confused," he said. "Why? What's wrong?" I was getting an inkling of what was happening. "Excuse me for a minute," he answered. The radiologist then went over to a telephone not far away, and I heard him calling my oncologist. "I don't understand. I have scans that show this patient's lymphatic system was ridden with cancer just 2 weeks ago, But now I can't find a lymph node on her body large enough to even suggest cancer, I heard him say. A smile broke across my face, and as he came back towards the table, I sat up and said, "Right, so I guess I can go now." "Not so fast," he responded. "Your oncologist insists that I find a lymph node to biopsy because it's not possible that you have no cancer in your body. Cancer doesn't just disappear like that. So I'll have to identify a node in an easy-to-access location, like your neck." He proceeded to mark a lymph node on my neck, even though it wasn't enlarged. I was then scheduled for surgery, and the surgeon made a small incision on the left side of my neck to remove one of my lymph nodes. Because this was done under local anesthetic, I was fully conscious. I really disliked the discomforting sensation I felt on my neck as the doctor cut the lymph node. I still remember smelling my own burning flesh as the surgeon cauterized my wound. I thought that maybe agreeing to let them do this wasn't such a good idea after all. However, once again, the results showed that there was no trace of cancer. At this point, I really started to protest the continued tests and drugs because deep down, I knew without a doubt that I was healed. I was also starting to get restless about being confined in the hospital. I wanted to get out and start exploring the world again, especially since I knew that I was going to be well. But the doctors resisted me, insisting I needed more tests and more drugs. They reminded me of the state I was in when I was admitted. "If you can't find any cancer in my body, why do I still need this?" I asked them. "Just because we can't find the cancer doesn't mean it's not there. Don't forget, you were terminal when you came in just a few weeks ago," they responded. But finally, they gave me a full-body positron emission tomography, also known as a PET scan, and when the results showed that I was free from cancer, my treatment came to an end. Also, to the amazement of the medical team, the arrangements they made with the reconstructive surgeon to close the lesions on my neck were unnecessary because the wounds healed by themselves. On March 9, 2006, 5 weeks after entering the hospital, I was released to go home. I was able to walk unaided, although I still needed a little bit of help to go up or down stairs. But I was in such a high state of euphoria that the doctors actually wrote in big letters across my hospital discharge slip, "Discharged to go home for further rest. No shopping or partying for at least 6 weeks." But I wasn't having any of that. Just 1 week later, for my birthday on March 16th, I went to my favorite restaurant, Jimmy's Kitchen, for dinner with my family to celebrate my new life. And the following week, on March 26th, I attended a friend's wedding. Much to the shock of my friends who knew what I'd gone through, I danced and drank champagne gleefully. I knew more than ever that life was to be lived with joy and abandon.